Good morning. There are several themes that run all the way through Mark's gospel. One, of course, is the identity of Jesus, as we heard in the opening song this morning. Who can he be? You, of course, know from the beginning he is the Messiah, the Son of God, chapter 1, verse 1. But inside the story, it takes them quite a while to figure it out. There's a second plot line running parallel to that, and that's, who are we? What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? And that, too, will go throughout the story. We've already heard something about it. Immediately after his own baptism and temptation, Jesus chooses Peter and Andrew and James and John. Now, today, we get, very subtly, a major part of that theme introduced for us. It's a little masked in English because it's under-translated. But even in Greek, it doesn't jump out and beat you over the head. You have to read it more than once, think about it more than a time or two before it begins to make itself clear. But it's there. And of course, the authors expect that you will read it more than once, hear it more than once, pray it more than once. So Mark does this very intricate structure. It's an interwoven tapestry, one scholar called it. Another way of thinking about it is literary architecture. Mark tells the story of Jesus, the story of discipleship, by telling the stories. And the way he puts the stories together and ties them together tells you what his theme is. On discipleship, we will see as we go along that Peter and Andrew and James and John and the other eight are a bunch of blockheads. They never do get it. Not in the gospel. Obviously, they did at some point, otherwise we wouldn't be here. Mark's audience knew that. But by the end of the gospel, they're still not on board. It's taken them half the gospel to figure out that Jesus is the Messiah. And by the other half, when the centurion finally recognizes him as Son of God, they're all long gone. So they are not the model of discipleship. They're disciples, but they're not the model of discipleship. What is discipleship? Mark tells us through the little people in the gospel. Many of the minor disciples are better models of discipleship than the major ones. And there are two in particular who stand out in this architecture, and one of them is right here, Simon's mother-in-law. Little quick story. They go home for the after synagogue Shabbat brunch, but the gal who's going to be fixing this stuff is with a fever. So Jesus cures her and she serves the meal. Move on from there. Well, if that's all it is, it doesn't tell us much. And much of what it tells us isn't terribly good, is it? Sounds like it's very confirming of the patriarchal role. His role was to pontificate and her role was to serve lunch. But there's more to it than that. Then the fever left her, it says, and she waited on them. That's the translation. But it's distinctly an under-translation. The Greek says, diakonai autois. She deaconed them. She served them. Now, where are we going to hear the word served again? The great central section of Mark, which we'll get to during the summer, has three acts of three scenes each. And each time Jesus predicts the passion, they do something in response that's incredibly stupid, and then he tries to teach them what it's really about. And by the third redo of this, he's totally frustrated. And he says, listen up, you imbeciles. Can't you get it through your heads? The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for the many. To serve. Same word in Greek. Now, two other things that spring out of this text. What do we know about Peter's mother-in-law? First of all, she's anonymous, right? We never do get her name. She's female. She's elderly. And she's a widow. We know that because she's living with her son-in-law. A choice that no woman would reasonably make had she the alternative to live with her husband instead. Twelve chapters later, at the very end of the public ministry, we meet another woman, also elderly, also anonymous, also a widow, in the temple. Jesus is preaching, and he sees her drop two small coins into the box. And he says, this woman has put in more than everybody else, because they all gave what they could spare. But she gave, translation again here is inadequate, normally says all that she had to live on. But the Greek says her whole life. Gave her whole life. Doesn't that bounce back to chapter 10? And to give his life as a ransom? So you've got this double arch architecture. Here's the widow here and the widow here, who are connected by being the only two poor elderly widows in the gospel. And then an arch from each of them meeting in the center at chapter 10, verse 45, where Jesus defines his ministry. I have come not to be served, but to serve. The Son of Man will give his life as a ransom for the many. These women get it. They understand who Jesus is, and they understand that their job is to do like that, to become like him, to serve, to give their lives. We need to learn, not so much from Peter, Andrew, James, and John, who are models of blockheadedness, but from these two women, what it means to be a disciple. It means service. It means giving your life. Remember our little triangle in the structure of the church? The community rests on word and sacrament and bears fruit in service. It is the service that ultimately defines us. That's what the community, the word, the sacrament is all leading up to, is the service. In your individual lives, you have to figure out for yourself how that works. It does mean, depending on who your family is, who your friends are, who your network is, that you set those people and their interests ahead of your own interests. If you are doing that for them and they're doing that for you, then it works. It's like 50-50. Preparing couples for marriage, I always tell them 50-50 never works because it's never 50-50. I always think of my 50, which I have to put effort into, as bigger than your 50. So 50-50 winds up 40-40, and for the lack of the 20 in the middle, it falls in. If I try to do 60 and you try to do 60, we're actually probably doing 50 in each, and it comes to work somewhere in the middle. Mutual service, mutual outpouring, mutual dedication. The parish level, the ministry of service. This is direct service stuff. Taking care of the guys in the park, serving the dinner Friday night, giving out the food Monday morning. It's also advocacy service stuff. Beyond the boundaries, inclusive housing, all those kinds of things. Beyond that, it's service in the community. It's service in the world. It's political service. Who do we choose for our leadership? What philosophies do we choose for our country? In all of these things, it's about outpouring. As much trouble as I'm having with this new sacramentary, and believe me, some of the languages, some things are really right. And one of them is in the translation of the cup, where it used to say, shall be shed. The new translation says, shall be poured out. Same meaning, different flavor. To shed blood sounds like something that one does involuntarily. To pour out blood sounds like, and he poured himself out, taking on the condition of a slave, and was found to be like us, even unto death. It's this pouring out of ourselves that constitutes real service. It's the way Jesus defined himself. It's the way these two widows understand themselves. It's the way we need to understand ourselves. Sisters and brothers, let us pray.